This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi there, I'm Brian Abana, and you're listening to the More Over Content Podcast.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to this week's More Over Podcast, the only rugby podcast that gives you all the news, views, and opinions, and all the catch your reaction, all the West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter, we are at More Over Podcast. We are More Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook, and you can find all of our podcasts on Anchor and Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast catcher type things. We're back for a new season in November, which feels a bit weird. There's some international stuff going on, and obviously it was a return to the Premiership. And I'm delighted to say that we have a full contingent this evening of regular contributors. That means we have the nicest man in Cornish rugby podcasting, Ben Eustace. Welcome, Ben.
Hello, mate. When you started to say contributors, I did wonder what you were going to say.
welcome back to a new season. We also have a farm vet who isn't any longer a farm vet, but is still qualified as a farm vet and the Houseboy's favourite, Phil Elkins. How you doing?
Still, once a farm vet, always a farm vet. It's the president of the United States. Once you're a farm vet, they can't take it away from you.
They cannot take it away. Once you're the Houseboy's favourite, they can't take that away either, unless you're accused of something sinister.
A bit like America, mother-in-law's favourite.
We've all been there, Rush.
A bit like the American president. and last but not least, everyone's favourite, other than Matt, who's in our fantasy rugby draft league, who's Ben's favourite. It's the Lensman. Welcome back, Lensman. How you doing?
Now then, I'm all right, actually. I'm all right.
I hope you all had a good weekend. Obviously, there were lots of rugby things going on. The Premiership is back after 2 weeks. Two or three weeks.
Who's doing the washing up?
Somebody having dinner?
It's Duke having dinner. It's the puppy.
Is that allowed? Does that mean we have to all go, we'll put up with that noise in the background because it's a cute,
I'm worried Doug's going to turn up and strangle him.
Has he got like a Grandmaster Flash clock hanging around his neck?
Yeah,
or
he's got like a metal tag and it's hitting the porcelain bowl, yeah.
I'll tell you what
he hasn't got, table manners.
Also, it's 20 to 9 at night. Has he got no routine?
Does what he wants, mate.
Unbelievable. Right, let's get right in and talk about some rugby, shall we? Hopefully, you know, all being well, we'll be back in some guise, in some formation, week on week now for the rest of the rugby season. Now we know that there's going to be no midweek matches ballsing things up, and hopefully we'll have some decent Premiership squads put out. But we're going to start in the international stage, the Autumn Nations Cup, which, you know, is rapidly turning into a Six Nations competition because Fiji keep having all their players having COVID and Georgia can't score any points against anybody. We'll kick off at Twickenham, England versus Ireland. Everybody would have seen that. And what could only be described as an imperious England performance, Phil?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this England team's always had that kind of growing edge of defensive control about them. And for the first probably 75 minutes, it was 100% England. Even although Ireland had the ball, some stupid, ridiculous amount of tackles that England made, 160, something like that. But every time Ireland had the ball, they just had no option to do anything with it. England were up in their faces all the time and making massive, big, dominant hits. I saw somebody, I can't remember who it was, saying that Billy Vinegar's half the player that he used to be. He's not. He's twice the player he used to be. He used to be just a big bulldozing wrecking ball of an eight, and now he adds so much more to his game. But we see Billy Vinopola hitting people and driving them backwards. He was doing that 3 or 4 years ago, and it's every player in the team being able to do it. And when you dominate teams like that, when they have the ball, it means when you've got the ball, they're knackered and they're... But it was really super impressive. The only slight thing just to be wary of from an England perspective is Ireland caught them out a couple of times with a little chip into the middle. And there's been a few occasions, I think Italy did it a couple of times as well, where when you're playing that real aggressive Mitchell-style defence, you do leave a bit of a gap there between that first line of defence and the back three. And I wonder whether it's something they need to build into their players, perhaps having one of the back, well, not necessarily back row forwards, but maybe one of the players who aren't in that back line just drifting in behind, covering that space a little bit. But you struggle to find fault with the way he played.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, and the fact that it took Ireland until like the 70th minute or whatever it was to actually try that little tactic. And it was something that was mentioned on commentary a couple of times around, you know, England's line speed, whether that was the flat line speed and in and around the ruck, or whether that was the wraparound line speed to stop Ireland going wide early. Ben, from an England, obviously we mentioned, Phil mentioned England defence there. Ireland's attack seemed a little bit toothless, a little bit rudderless and one-dimensional. Would you think that was because of England's defence or a bit of a lack of leadership?
I was going to say, so would you if you had the entire English back row in your face. I mean, the fly-half was pretty nondescript, wasn't he, Byrne? And you know, I thought the scrum half played really well against Wales. He does have a really nice service, but with the way the game went, with them not getting a lot of clean ball off set piece and with the line speed sort of being all over them, it was a kind of a game that was tailor-made for someone a bit more like Murray, a sort of big scrum half that can wrestle the ball out. So without Murray and Sexton, maybe they were a bit rudderless, but that takes quite a lot away from England's defence. I mean, I don't like to say it, but they're starting to look a lot like Saracens, aren't they?
Oh, fucking hell. Steady away.
You know, Doug, it's that very aggressive defence. Exeter's defence is very good, but it as a rule, doesn't push you back 20 yards. Which England were doing. They were knocking them backwards. And Phil's point about Billy Vinopola is a really good one. And, you know, I was hoping it might have put to bed a few of these sort of clickbaity things about Tom Willis and Sam Simmons being a disgrace they're not in the side. I mean, that back row was outstanding. And with Atodja there just making a mess of everything, they're incredibly hard to play against.
He's a joke, isn't he, Atodja?
I can't believe there's people out there who are saying that it's a disgrace that Johnny May wasn't man of the match. I could have picked five men of the match and none of them would have been in the backs.
Yeah. Doug, like what...
It was all about back row, second row, front row, just dominating.
That was the best I've seen Sinclair play for 12 months.
Yeah, agree. Doug, what did you make of it?
I think Ireland may be... I think they're a bit directionless. I'm not sure Andy Farrell... It's a sort of... they've evolved, they've not revolved.
But, or have they revolved, not evolved?
Yeah. I just think England, like, for whatever you may think about it, Eddie Jones is... weird ideas on what's right and wrong. They have got a solid 15 that are probably only two sides in the world would be that can sort of live with them. But it worries me more for the state of Six Nations and European rugby in general, really, because if England are just going to start brushing aside Ireland, where does that leave the Six Nations? It felt a little bit... England are really good. I don't think it's a very good signal for the state of rugby as a whole. I think they played all right. I don't think it was a brilliant performance by England. But
I think
the thing that came out of that for me was that Ireland should start worrying.
Yeah. I think Ireland are about 6 months, let's say 6 months in relative time terms behind Wales, because Wales are an absolute shit show at the moment. They've got some fantastic players, but they are a shit show. And since Gatland left...
If you're a young Irish player and you're seeing people like James Lowe and the scrum half and the four... you know what I'm like with names, but they seem to be... Seems to be a value of... They seem to be saying that the Irish players that are coming through aren't good enough, so we need to get these foreign-born guys in, and that should be a worry, really.
Well, it's basically sort of Leinster, isn't it? That's the issue that Ireland seem to have, is that, you know, Leinster have been dominating right up there in European rugby for such a long time. They've almost taken that blueprint and sprinkled it with a couple of Ulster and a few more Munster players and tried to make it work. Now, Ben, you mentioned around the back row is probably, Phil, you're probably the most qualified to talk about this with regards to positional sense. But, you know, all of the chat pre-match or, you know, in the last couple of weeks has been around Jack Willis. It's been around Sam Simmons. It's been around Itoje playing six. All of the options that England have got. Eddie went back to the tried and trusted Vunipola, Curry and Underhill back row. And any team in world rugby would be very happy to have those three as their starting back row, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so Rob Baxter was asked about Sam Simmons, I think about 18 months ago, and said, what does he need to get more Ireland games? And he said, well, probably put on 30 kilos, which at the time might have been a slightly blasé answer, but had a bit of truth to it. They asked him exactly the same question on Friday night after Sam Simmons gets a hat-trick for Exeter. What does he have to do to get more game time for England? And Baxter's answer was actually far more nuanced and correct. Actually, what Ed Jones' job to do is to pick a team that he thinks is going to be most likely to win for England. And it's going to be the team that plays in the system that he wants to play. Now, what you've seen is, I mentioned him earlier, John Mitchell. As John Mitchell's come into that England setup, they've changed the way they play defensively massively. And the way they play now, Curry and Underhill, let's stick with the flankers to start with. Curry and Underhill are going to be those first two choice flankers every game. They're exactly what he wants for that kind of system. And Billy now is Billy 5 years ago. Billy now is exactly what you want as well. The chances of him going back to the old fullback for number of Nathan Hughes, I think, are pretty much zero, because he doesn't match the style of play that England are trying to play now. He doesn't want a big bullocking number eight that's got 50-60 minutes in him. He wants somebody to bit. Did Billy play the full game at the weekend?
He never
used to be able to stick that out. He wants somebody who's a bit more rounded, but also going to get in people's faces in defence. And what Sam Simmons does, he does a lot more work with ball in hand. He does a lot more work out in the wide channels. He does a lot more work almost as a bit of an extra centre at times. And that's not what the England system at the moment is about. So you pick the players that are exactly the best players for the system that you're playing. Similarly, Marcus Smith is probably not going to get the game time that his skill set deserves. But I don't know. You say Sam Simmons is born Dublin. He's probably got 30, 40 caps under his belt by now. You say Marcus Smith is born in France. He's probably got 50 or 60 caps under his belt by now. But they're not the kind of players that suit the system that England are trying to play at the moment. So it doesn't mean they're crap players. It doesn't mean that it's a disgrace that they're not picked either. They're just not the right players at the right time for the right system.
And I think people need to start to realise that in the last, well, since Eddie Jones took over following the debacle that was the 2015 World Cup, right? Eddie Jones took over that team that was in fairly disarray. We went to Australia. We did really well in Australia. He's cultivated, nurtured players. He's brought people in. He's dropped people out. England have been ultimately successful, more successful than not over that period of time. We've won a couple of Six Nations. We got to the final of a World Cup. Yes, we didn't win it, but, you know, we came up against a better side on the day. That happens, right? Where I've come round to the thinking that if England were now, look, if you were comparing England now to where Ireland and Wales are, based on the fact that they're using pretty much the same players, but they've got a different head coach, what is the better option like for England? People don't like Eddie Jones. Where is a better option for England? I don't see one. England are successful at the moment. They may not be playing the most attractive brand of rugby. There's a lot talked about international rugby now being played more specifically when you haven't got the ball than when you have got the ball. What do you make of that theory and that approach to playing with minimal possession and just utilize it when you've got it?
I just think that they've decided, notably England, and you can see it because, you know, the group that we're in, Russ, you know, there's a bit of controversy about Farrell kicking away possession too much. But I think watching it now, I think they've come to the conclusion that it's the new interpretation of the laws make it so dangerous to attack in a wide channel that they just have a look. They make a few yards from the pack and then they have a look at going wide. And if it's not on, then one of the backs just puts it into the corner. There's no attempt to even go through two or three phases out wide. I think if May hadn't have seen that gap, he wasn't going to go for it anyway. He was just going to hoof that down the pitch. And I think they've just decided that the risk reward, especially with the way back rows are rewarded for getting to the ball now. So I still think Farrell's overkicking it in the 22, because I think, you know, they scored a try off his second kick, but the first one he did in that situation was, there was no percentage to that whatsoever. But I think he's actually playing to a game plan, maybe overdoing it a little bit because he likes a kick anyway. But I think that's why there is a lot of boot to ball. And the All Blacks, when they were winning World Cups consecutively, they were kicking the ball away more than anyone else.
It's because they'd have a good chase concept. And then they would turn the ball over in opposition territory. And like you say, it's not a new concept. But does it make
Saracens won every single tournament they entered by doing that.
Yeah. If you've got Underhill chasing a high ball, you've got a pretty decent chance he's going to knock it loose. And one of Itoje's sort of real skills seems to be anticipating where the ball's going to be, as well as all the dark arts, whatever you want to call it, that he's got sort of in the locker. He's also got extremely good anticipation.
Bit racist.
Some people might find what you said a bit racist.
Johnny May is unbelievable under the high ball as well.
Yeah, exactly. And Watson, when he's in, is fantastic as well.
Let me tell you somebody who's not awesome under the high ball. That's Elliot Daly.
Oh, no. Good night.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah.
Watson's back in the squad for next, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're all fairly certain that Watson's a better 15 than Daly now. But the other thing is, if you roll the clock back to, well, probably 18 months, we were box kicking a lot, but those box kicks were going too far and not contestable. So credit to Ben Young, his kicks have got better. But also, because of the changes in the interpretations of the laws. And because we're effectively playing counter-attacking rugby, Ben Youngs has got a damn sight quicker around the breakdown. That ball is shifting away a lot quicker. Now, I don't think he's the answer, the long-term answer, even the short-term answer to England's issues at nines, but he's not standing out as such a force of negativity.
Do you not think, though, like, based on your point there, you say about Ben Youngs' service being a bit quicker, is that not a product of the fact that the rucks are, especially England's rucks at the moment, they're a lot closer? And Doug, you being a nine, if you're not going from side to side to side to side, picking balls out of rucks 40, 50 metres apart, you're going to be in a better position to provide quicker service. If you've got if you're going 10 metres maximum to each ruck, and then there's potentially a kick, it makes it stands to reason that your service is going to be quicker, doesn't it?
I mean, first off, yeah, I'm a nine in name only. Let's not kid ourselves that anything I say about being a nine has any relevance to anything in the game of rugby. But what I would say,
Russ
is
wants
that,
us to be relatable.
Relatable. I'm a third team nine, so there you go. Relate to that.
and swivel.
Yeah. If you want to talk about being a high level football fullback, we can talk about that. But we'll go on my nine experience. And I'll level with you. If play goes side to side, I ain't getting to the ruck. So, you know, the ball's as slow as you like because it's not coming from nine in that situation. But in terms of international rugby, I would suggest that aimless phase play across the width of a pitch. Obviously, that's not what England want to do. That I think it's pretty self-evident what England want to do, and that's pretty much what Saracens do, which is they know that they're more powerful than every other team, so they just batter people into submission. And yes, it's not boring. Yes, it's extremely boring, but it's been proven to work over and over and over again.
I like it. A couple of examples on the Ben Youngs thing, though. There was a case on Saturday where he put in a box kick. England turned the ball over, not overly clean, but obviously back three were tied in, and he straight away went for a little chip and run over the top. Now, I don't think he would have done it 18 months ago. I think he would have slowed it right down, given it to a fat forward to trough it up a few yards and really slowed it down. Equally, I get what you're saying, Russ. If you're not having to run 60 yards, not blowing when you get there, and you can get there a bit quicker. But there were times 18 months ago where we were making half breaks, three-quarter breaks, getting behind their line and pushing them backward, and then waiting 3 seconds for the ball to be passed. And it's going so much quicker now, even when you've got front foot forward ball. Now, I can't see that he's changed as a player. So it's got to be something about his system, or it's got to be something about his confidence and his mindset. I don't really know, but he doesn't stand out as a substandard player within that team, which I think he did 18 months ago.
And Ben Youngs has done this for 150 caps. He'll have four or five games where he looks like a world-class nine, and then he'll regress to what he actually is, which is a plodding nine who just sort of game manages.
Seen is Ian Bell, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
He'll score a lovely
he's late stage Alistair Cook, where every time you think he's just about to be dropped, he'll make a double hundred. Yeah.
A lovely century in the third innings when you're already 500 runs ahead.
Exactly. I don't think he's the best nine we've got. I don't think he's probably in the top five we've got. Going on what Richard Wigglesworth did on Saturday, I'd say he's probably behind Richard Wigglesworth in terms of actual ability and fit to the system. But he's doing a job. He's doing the job that he wants to do. Yeah.
And Eddie clearly likes him. Has anybody else got anything that they want to talk about England?
I just want to say about that. The Johnny May try, that's the first time since COVID came into our lives that I've genuinely missed the crowds at a game. because the roar that would have been going up as May set off.
Well, it was almost like you can imagine it, the only thing that I can equate it to, you, the amount of times I've watched that Chris Ashton try against Australia.
Yeah, it's funny. There, we all said that at work. Yeah, it was the Chris Ashton try, that noise, the sort of when one half of the ground, the people sitting at the side of the pitch that can see that there's no cover, they start the roar and then it just sort of spreads around the ground. It's the one time that I've really missed it.
But the announcement today, or what I've seen today, is that they're going to start letting fans back in the stadiums, right? As of next week or week after next, 4,000.
Yeah.
4,000 capacities. And
I mean, luckily that still means that Sale could have still got about 3,000 tickets they can sell.
In an industrial estate, imagine they'll still be in tier three, mate. So it's not.
You know how like most sports stadiums that you want a nice little pub next to it or something like that. Do you know what Sale have got next to their ground now?
I don't know.
An Audi.
An
Audi.
Ben, you wanted in?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the back row chat just for a minute. Just those articles were doing my head in. There was one this morning sort of saying about Sam Simmons could start for the Lions and not get into the England squad, and I just think I don't see the point of these articles. And this is no knock on Sam Simmons, who's a fantastic player, but I don't know, I think if you think, I mean, look how long it took Gatland to pick Tipperich. I don't think that Simmons is going to be his cup of tea either.
I'd agree with that. And I'd also say along those same similar lines that Sam Simmons is what, 22, 23?
Yeah.
And Billy Vunipola breaks his arm every 4 weeks. So, let's...
If there's one Lions tour that probably doesn't suit Sam Simmons, it's South Africa,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you look at how highly Gatlin rated Lydia.
He's 26.
You just think Underhill's going to be right up his street.
Mm.
But yeah, I think it's just, you've just got to leave it now. I think Doug is right. Simmons is going to get some caps eventually, even if it takes Eddie Jones going. Someone's going to give him some caps. And I can't remember who said it in the last podcast, but even on the England bench, you've got Ben Earl who does the same things as Simmons. He's just a bit bigger. And it is just going to be a size problem for now.
And it's not even a size problem. It's like horses for courses, isn't it? Eddie Jones has clearly set his stall out for what he wants, and at the moment, it's not Sam Simmons. I'm under no illusion, and I know it's been talked about before. Sam Simmons, Joe Simmons.
His time will come because he's got probably four World Cups left in him, and yeah. I would argue that it's probably going to be Ford and Farrell's last at the next one.
And there are players across the Premiership that will probably, feel aggrieved that they're not getting picked or whatever.
It's slightly more baffling that Jacob Umang is getting into the squad and Joe Simmons isn't. That's more.
But that was, they mentioned that in the commentary. I mean, we can come on to the Premiership. They mentioned that in the commentary yesterday that, the reports coming out of the England camp is that Eddie Jones really likes the way that Jacob Umaga approaches things. He likes the way he does this, he does that. And the only time I've seen when Jacob Umaga didn't have Jimmy Gopoff at 12 when he was injured, Wasps and Umaga were rubbish. Right? And yes, that is a learning thing. He was new into the Premiership. He was growing into it. All of that sort of stuff, completely accepted, right? And I'm not saying that Umanga is a rubbish player. What I'm saying is that as far as, and I've said this before on the podcast, I think, is that if he likes the way Umanga plays, then he will pick Umanga at 10 and Farrell at 12, the same way that he has Gopoff outside him at Wasps.
Yep.
Because it is a game management thing.
My last point on Billy Vunipola would be that it's going to be harder to justify picking Billy Vunipola when he's not playing for Saracens all year if Sam Simmons is scoring three tries every week for Exeter. It's going to become, it's going to get to the point where you cannot justify it.
Well, he can justify it though, because provided Billy Vanapona keeps putting in good performances for England,
you can't. You just cannot justify picking someone who's playing no competitive rugby over somebody who's playing for the European champions, and scoring and playing well every week.
I agree with you entirely, but if we know anything by now, Eddie Jones doesn't want or look to justify whatever he does to anybody. He'll just do what he wants. So I think Ben was right. We just all need to stop saying Eddie should do this, Eddie should do that. You know, it's inherent in any team sport, in any management, that they get second guessed. Ultimately, until England start underperforming for a prolonged period of time, we all just need to step back.
My personal preference would be for Eddie Jones to be relieved of his post, because I think his act has worn thin, and I don't care if we're winning. I think his act has worn thin. He's become a bit of a Mourinho character for me.
But then, you know,
I just don't listen to his interviews. I watch for rugby. But going back to Joe Simmons, as long as Owen Farrell's fit, Joe Simmons doesn't really get any game time, because he's an Owen Farrell replacement, not a George Ford replacement in the role that George Ford plays. Mm-hmm. And Owen Farrell will play 80 minutes if he's available. So, yeah. He just needs to wait for Farrell to retire or get hurt or get banned.
I know this has been put out there a lot on the various rugby pages over the last couple of days. But the sooner England replace Maro Itoje as captain over Owen Farrell, the better, as far as I'm concerned, as far, not just culturally, not just for, you know, I think having listened to him talk and watched a couple of interviews and seen the way that he conducts himself, you don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but I see him as an incredible leader of this England side for years and years to come.
I don't think you can say that Farrell hasn't been.
No, Farrell has put himself in the shop window a little bit for some, you know, indiscretions. Maro Itoje isn't by any means sort of blemish free, and he does live sort of life on the edge. But Farrell has done nothing wrong for me to say this. I'm not saying sack Farrell now, but what I'm saying is that I would like personally to see Itoje as England captain sooner rather than later.
I agree. I think Farrell is a very, very good player, but I think he's not quite as undroppable as his reputation.
I also think he's a bit of an abrasive character that maybe tends to rub referees up the wrong way, potentially.
I think that's the important point. I think every England team at the moment is going to have Farrell and Itoje as two leaders. Leaders on the pitch, leaders in the way they behave. They're the people pulling other players in together and having the kind of words with the players. All a captain is really is who's that liaison with the ref. And I think Itoje would probably do a better job of that than Farrell. And Farrell is very much will be very much in referee's spotlights as much as he'll be very much in other coaches' spotlights because of some of the stuff that he does. Now, if you can distance him from the refs a little bit, that might not be a bad thing.
Yeah, and Farrell is always going to be in that spotlight, like forever now. His tackle technique, it will always, always come into question. He might not make another high tackle for 3 or 4 years in international rugby, right? But then he'll do one in 4 years' time if he's still playing for England, and everybody going, oh, fucking hell, Owen Farrell, he's such a fucking... His tackle technique is questionable. And that will always be there. Anyway, we've done, 30-odd minutes on England when I said, well, we'll just fly through and we'll do 15 minutes and we'll make it a 45-minute pod, yeah? 33 minutes in. Right. Did you guys want to talk anything about France or Scotland-France yesterday? I'm not entirely sure how this Nations Cup is going to work, but I assume if England beat Wales on Saturday, then it'll be England-France at Twickenham on the week after, right?
Yep, and then Ireland, Scotland, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Italy, Fiji, Georgia.
And you say, I mean, you mentioned almost at the start when we started talking about England, Doug, that England developing a brand to dominate in the state of European rugby. France, you know, they didn't blow Scotland away yesterday. There was a lot of... It was bitty, that game yesterday, wasn't it? It was lots of penalties, lots of mistakes, and Stuart Hogg had an absolute mare. But they've got two very much contrasting styles. And do you think the way that England play, and I'm just going to ask this as sort of a round-off question, really. France like to run the ball. France like to, and they've got the players to do it. Do you think the England style of kicking them deep and making them run it back would favour England more than that the young French side that's coming out now?
I think like any game, it'd come down to the forward battle, wouldn't it? I think with France, usually you've got to hold them at the scrums, although I don't think they're quite as strong as they were, although Scotland got properly seen off, didn't they, in the scrums. I don't know, the risk with France is that they're capable, because of Vakatawa and Dupont in particular, of making something out of pretty much nothing. So if you're kicking the ball back to them, then there is that risk, but then there's also the risk, France being France, of them chucking an intercept or dropping the ball. You know, it's I think they'll just, England are just going to keep to that tactic against everyone. I don't think there's going to be a change to it whatsoever. The only thing I would take out of the French game, not the only thing, but there was a really good Brit piece of refereeing by Wayne Barnes.
Was that the...
The video referee.
And Ben, I'll tell you what, I'll come on to this when we talk about the Premiership, but Ben Whitehouse inserting himself into that game on a number of occasions, and Wayne Barnes going, yeah, I saw all that. I'll have a look at it, but I'm pretty confident about what I saw.
Yeah.
And then what he saw was exactly the same as what happened on the replay, and it all just carried on, which was, you know, Wayne Barnes is by some distance the best referee on the planet. And I know, yeah, you can fucking snooze away, but, you know... Next, I'll be saying he talks French as well.
The collective group wank off of Wayne Barnes is one of the most nauseating Twitter topics in the history of rugby.
It's nearly as nauseating as the collective wanking off of Nigel Owens 2 years ago.
Yeah, but they're not quite. They're not in the same.
You know what? I'd rather I didn't know who Wayne Barnes was.
You're right. Moving back to the rugby, I think both, as Ben alluded to, but it's very much the same as Scotland, particularly a Finn Russell or an Adam Hastings control of Scotland, as it is for France, in that a little part of them relies on some magic. England's game plan is very controlling. The France and in particular the Scotland game plans are very kind of free-flowing and expressive rugby. And the question comes down to, can you completely control that? And 9 times out of 10, you can. 1 time out of 10, you're going to lose that game because they just click with a little bit of magic and you can't control for that. You can scramble as well as you can.
I think France will come, they'll become more and more pragmatic as...
Yeah, I think France is probably more 6 or 7 times out of 10 you can control it than 9 times.
He's got
Scotland
players
9 times out of 10 you can control it.
Yeah, he's got players in, sort of starting to get them in a little bit to his style. Like Aldrete, he doesn't perhaps run in open play like Picamol used to, but he never stops running, does he?
He got absolutely smashed. I can't remember who it was by. He got absolutely smashed by a couple of the Scotland players, got the ball standing still, tried to put some momentum in and got driven back about 10 yards. And you looked and you go, that's probably a tide changer, but then the Scots never really built on it.
The one going back to the referees.
And that little shake of the fist was because Theo Walcott's just broke his duck for Southampton.
The one bit of red hot referee action that did make me laugh was when
hot referee action.
Yeah.
there is tonight's podcast title.
That's what we all tune in for, that red hot referee action.
Blow my whistle, guys. It was when Nigel was the video referee, wasn't he? And he came in and the ref said, "Oh, where's the mark?" And he went, "Just about where you fell over."
Oh, God.
Well, I just want to say about Scotland, they are my favourite team to watch at the moment. I love their back row. Jamie Rich is just an amazing player. I think he'll be in the Premiership before too long. Hamish Watson's fantastic. I really like I really like their that Duhan van der Merwe, you know, Muck van der Merwe. He's an absolute beast. And obviously, they suffered for not having either Finn Russell or Adam Hastings. I do think they're just fun to watch, and their stash is absolutely incredible. I love both of their kits, and they're both Macron kits. So there you go. That's all I want to say about Scotland.
Macron kits.
I'd rather watch Scotland than any other international rugby team at the moment. I think the way they play the game is really good.
That's fair enough. Right. Let's segue away from there, because you mentioned Macron kits, and I'm going to tenuously segue from one Macron team to another. The Premiership kicked off Friday night, and Doug, you had the pleasure of being at the mecca of rugby, I would say, the AJ Bell, you know, with a full stadium, if that's ever happened, you know, a real atmospheric place.
Yeah,
A real icon of English rugby. To watch your beloved Northampton Saints. Well, you were obviously working, but you got to watch Northampton Saints' first game of the season against Sale. How was it?
Not brilliant. Slightly worrying. I don't understand why anyone thinks that this season is any different from last year. So this season is going to carry on in the vein that last year finished. And Northampton, since the 24th of January, since the 18th of January, when we beat Lyon away in France, have won twice. And those victories have been against London Irish and Worcester. Now,
that is worrying.
I don't understand why chopping this season up and saying, oh, it's a new season, you know, Saints are going to do this, they're going to do that. No. Saints have won two games in almost a calendar year. And I know a few months of that was missing because of COVID, whatever, but we've lost to practically everyone in the Premiership quite convincingly at times. And my main concern about Saints is that we've sort of, they say in the NFL that you need to zag when other teams zig. You need to be different, stay ahead of the curve. In the Premiership, if you do that, which is what Saints are trying to do, you are going to get pumped. You look at the Sale team, and they had seven players in their pack from six from South Africa and one from Russia, who had arms quite literally unlike anything I've ever seen. They were frightening. And we had, admittedly, one of my favourite ever Saints.
Rave Ribbons?
Rave Ribbons on the bench. Alex Waller. And we had Alex Moon. But basically, we've constructed a team that would compete in Super Rugby. Because what our coach wants to do is move quickly, shift the ball around the park and beat teams with pace. Our back line, Tom Collins on the wing, he looks like a child on a rugby field with these people. He looks like a child. Yeah. We are completely unprepared for what the Premiership has become, which is just blunt force and complete lack of flair. Sale have got the message. They've seen Exeter and they've seen Saracens buying up these people who are just, they're not humans. They're like a different species. They're these huge sort of missing link type people. Wasps are sort of getting there. Bristol are doing it. They're just getting huge. You look at Exeter, they're, you know, I don't even know what they are. And the teams that aren't doing it are suffering. So Saracens, Harlequins. But then they're getting bigger. Saints, not so much. And the worrying thing for me is that we've done all of our business now. This is what we've got to get through to the end of the season. We haven't won in a year. I genuinely think that we're going to go down this season. You look at the squad of London, I think it'll be between, and especially after that Newcastle result, you look at the squads and you think, without Reinach, there's not a lot there. And it's painfully obvious just what Reinach did for Saints. He froze entire teams. They were terrified of him. Absolutely yeah. terrified. Couldn't live with his pace. Yeah, couldn't live with his pace.
Where they were taking backward steps when they should have been taking forward steps.
Absolutely.
He was a complete game changer.
And what teams do when they see Saints now is they think, well, we're just going to pace them in the scrum. Every time we have a scrum, we're going to get a penalty. That puts pressure on the backs. Can't drop the ball. If we drop the ball, we're going to give away a penalty. And Chris Boyd's got a lot of thinking to do. If I was him, I'd be raiding every championship team for their biggest player. I'd just be going and pick, right, who is your biggest player? Give him to me. Because, yeah, we've got a lot of technically good players. And like I say, we'd be a fantastic Super Rugby side, but we're going to get pumped every week until something changes, and I don't know how it's going to change.
You can be as big as you like, but if you can't retain possession or maintain a set piece, you're going to be banging trouble, aren't you?
No, mate, that's not the case. It's not the case. You can be as big as you like and just bludgeon people out.
No, sorry, I meant
as they capitulate.
What I meant was. And I didn't say that as big as you like. I meant to say you could be as technical as you like and have as much ability as you like. But unless you were able to maintain possession and set piece and physically hold up against teams, you're going to be in the shit.
Yeah. Our packs, there's some great players there. It's just that they're not big enough. They're just not big enough.
And
you can tell teams think we're soft. Teams think we're soft.
And that's not a good place to even to be turning up at a game, even before the whistle's even blown. If that's people's mentality before the whistle's blown, it's a difficult
position. I also think that Ben Franks, who is like a thin U, is the worst rugby player with the biggest reputation I've ever seen. He is absolutely terrible at being a prop forward at rugby. He just needs to go. He's embarrassing. How that guy played for New Zealand, I've no idea. He's an embarrassment.
I guess it's a bit of reputation, but also in that New Zealand team, he would have been right down the bottom of the pecking order, wouldn't he? Just do your job. Whereas now he played
like 80 tests for the All Blacks. He won a World Cup. It.
Yeah, but my point is, at that time, at the peak of his powers, that he was probably just asked to do a single thing, and now he's not very good.
He's
at
only asked to do a single thing at Saints. Like, don't get folded in half every time we go into a scrum, and he's singularly incapable of doing it, just like his shitter older brother.
Is he not about a million years old now? I don't even know.
His spine probably is, judging by the way he gets folded up for Northampton every week.
You mentioned. Like power and grinding teams down. That's exactly what Exeter did to Harlequins. I mean, anybody that wasn't a Northampton or a Sale fan on Friday night, I'd imagine would have been watching Exeter versus Harlequins with all the games being on telly. And that's exactly what Exeter did. Exeter did not put in a great performance by any stretch of the imagination. They had that one bit of magic in the first half from Sam Simmons. That was exceptional. And the game was stop start after that. And then, like I say, the last 15, 20 minutes, Exeter scored like 20 points and just literally Quinns had nothing left. They had no answer. And the old adage of playing a rugby match for 80 minutes and you're not winning it within the first half, but put yourself in a position not to lose it. It has never been more true. And Rob Baxter said that exact thing afterwards, is that, you know, you don't win many rugby matches by half time, especially in the Premiership nowadays, because it's all very much tight and power orientated.
Playing Saints, you've won it before you turned up.
Well, poor Saints. But Exeter, they didn't play great, but you know, they've had 2 weeks off, probably getting over a couple of massive monumental hangovers. So that's fair enough. You mentioned
they were playing like their eighth choice team and they spanked Harlequins.
Harlequins did not get a sniff all day.
I don't want to sort of put a downer on this, because I really enjoyed the rugby this week, but we're basically now in for 8 months, or however long it is, 6 months of rinse and repeat from last year until clubs can go and buy players again, because we've essentially had a season and a half
of
the same squads. So what's going to change? Nothing's going to change. Exeter are going to walk the league. Wasps are going to finish second or third. Bath will be up there and everyone else will fight out for the fourth position. And I as long as the rugby's good, I won't mind, but you've seen what we're going to get, because we had half a season from last year and it's going to be exactly as, you know, they had 3 weeks off. They have longer than that off sometimes during the season anyway. If you take into account the Premiership Cup and international breaks, they can be off playing Premiership rugby for a month. So, you know, I don't know what to suggest. I don't know what to say. Leicester looked decent. Irish and Worcester both looked all right with a lot of players missing. Worcester had their two of their best players missing. I think Newcastle were a competent team. They had for some reason, a lot of injuries.
Yeah. I watched a lot of that game at the Rec on Saturday. And I think to a certain extent, Bath let Newcastle off the hook. I thought that they potentially underestimated them a little bit. And even when they managed to keep nudging themselves ahead, they never got themselves into a position to really put Newcastle to bed, and they allowed them back into it. There is one thing that I wanted to talk about the Bath Newcastle game is some of the referees, and I'm going to single out Craig Maxwell Keys here, and I've done it before, and the fact that he refereed the Premiership final, because literally every other referee that the RFU had available was on international duty. That game probably went on for about 20 minutes longer than it should have done in total, because for every single little thing, he kept referring to the TMO. And between him and the TMO,
I just really don't like the way he says advantage.
It was so frustrating. There was at least three occasions where he clearly saw what had happened. He told the TMO what had happened. They looked at it again and again and again and again.
It's because they get on telly, mate.
It's fun. but it's so obvious why they do it. But it was time off for about 3.5 minutes while they reviewed replay after replay. When the first replay showed them what happened, which was exactly what he said had happened to start off with, and they went round and round and round in circles, and then they came to the same decision that he said it was the decision he gave, without even going to the TMO. And it's like,
they refer something to the TMO and they appear on telly for a minute or more, it sticks £100 a night on their after dinner sinking fee for when they retire.
It's just fucking, but it's killing the game. And it killed that Bath Newcastle game, because every single tiny little thing, instead of, like, there was a point, it was Thocken the Seagulls' try, the first try, right? He said, right at the time, I was there, I saw it, it was flat. Try given. It's a try. It's a flat pass. Try. they went back and whether it was him or the TMO or whatever, they reviewed it for about 3 minutes looking at angles, and they didn't actually have an inline side on angle. They didn't have one. So what's the fucking point?
Because
yeah, but so whether it was or whether it wasn't, they didn't have a side on angle. He'd already said in his own mind it was flat, so they'd had to manufacture an angle to prove that it was forward when they didn't have an angle. So just fucking get on with it. No one's going to appeal it. Get on with it.
Agreed.
Just get on with the game.
Yeah, very much so. If you want to talk about, did you hear about the stamping incident at Leicester?
No.
So let me think if I can remember who it was. One of the Gloucester players, I think it was their hooker, Kiwi hooker, stamped on one of the Leicester players. If you can find it, have a look at it. Basically the Gloucester player was on the floor doing that shit house thing where you hold people, you know, he's holding the guy down. It looked to me like he was going for the Charlies and missed, but was holding on to the guy, and the guy punched his arm away, as you can do, and then he went back and tried to hold him again, and so the Gloucester player just sort of stood on his chest. I wouldn't say it was a stamp as such, but social media went nuts, and I just want to say that the referee in that instance, he yellow carded both players, which I thought was one of the best decisions I've seen in a long time, actually, because none of it would have happened if the Gloucester player hadn't been being held. Yeah. But again, Twitter, Leicester fans in particular.
It sounds like a prime example of you shouldn't have been a cunt.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have retaliated for him being a cunt. You're both going to the bin. See you later.
Exactly. And that was, it was a very, really good
decision. That's the exact phrase he used, wasn't it, Doug?
Imagine a referee doing that. That would go down so well.
They're both just being cunts there, aren't they, Kitty? Yeah, they are, mate. Yeah, yeah. Should I just send them both off? Yeah, all right,
Excuse me,
yeah.
Skipper. Come, Skipper.
These two being a cunt.
if he wasn't being a cunt, then he wouldn't have had to retaliate to him being a cunt.
Yeah.
And as it is, they're both a pair of cunts. They're going to the bin. 10 minutes.
You're both a pair of cunts. Off you go.
If anyone listens to this with their kids...
A bit late now, Ben.
Yeah. It's only been like 5 years we've been doing this. If you're still listening to it with your kids, you've got to evaluate your parenting.
James.
I want to talk about Leicester. I know you want to sort of wrap this up.
No, mate, you're fine.
Leicester looked good. Without Ben Youngs, without George Ford, without... you know, the prop fella, you know what I mean.
Dan Cole.
Genge, that's the one. Freddie Stewart looked fantastic at fullback. I think he's going to be a really good player. Their new winger, Van Vijk, where they found this fella, I don't know, but he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Tauta in the centres was good.
Did you say Van Vijk?
Yeah.
Scotland, mate.
Scotland?
Same place as the one that's starting from comes from.
Oh, right.
from the Scottish Van Wicks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a winger called Harry Potter. So do with that what you will. How long before Ali Eakin makes a joke about that in a pre-match?
It's been done.
I'm not having Zach Henry. I think he's pony. But Wigglesworth was, you know... He just did those were things.
But the thing is, a team like Leicester, they need someone like Wigglesworth to just give them a little bit of direction, a little bit of calm, maybe.
Honestly, I think he'll keep Ben Youngs out the side. I really do. I just think the control he brings to a game is just you can't put a price on that. And they've unearthed this number 8, Jasper Visa, who I think is the brother or some related to that hooker that plays for Sale.
Van de Merver?
No, Visa.
Oh.
I'm sure anyway, he was bloody brilliant. And even their kit looked good. Which, when you see pictures of it, it shouldn't look good. But the white shorts and the black socks, loving it.
Oh, is it Cobus Fisa from Sale?
Yeah, that's the fella. That's his brother or cousin.
Ben Young signed a contract fairly recently. I wouldn't surprise me if he doesn't have it in there that when he's back, when he's not playing internationally, he has to play a set number of games.
I think between, I mean, it's a sensible move to have him and Wiggy as a one and two punch scrum half partnership, depending on horses for courses. Ben Young's off the bench or Wrigglesworth off the bench. It makes sense, doesn't it? You know, they've struggled for key positions for a while, Leicester, and it's a bit of a shrewd signing, I think. Steve Borthwick is
put it this way, they're in no danger of going down with the signings they've made. No danger whatsoever.
That must feel real shit, just based on what you said about Northampton.
I mean, hopefully the championship won't go ahead, so we can't go down. But I'm telling you now, if it does go ahead, we're in a spot above it. But to peel the onion back, Russ, you mentioned on our WhatsApp there's been a little bit of chat about TV production and stuff.
Oh yeah,
on the games. I just want to say there was a try in this Leicester game where there was a hint of a forward pass. When I say hint, I mean it was a mile forward, and the TMO only looked at one angle. And I probably shouldn't say this, but then another angle appeared, and he went, "Oh." After he'd said, "Yeah, that's fine," he went, said to the director, "Oh, yeah, that one looks forward, doesn't it?" A bit late now, mate.
Oh, you've already given it sunshine.
Yeah. Just for anyone out there that thinks that the Amazon coverage has been a bit pony, literally to a man, the same crew that did the Premiership final. So if you think the coverage was any different.
Same director.
Yep. Same cameraman. Rousey was there with his odd socks. You know, the director would have been Steve Mac, not Steve McNamara. That's the ITV guy. What's his name? I can't remember his name.
Am I right in thinking that it's the same? The camera
Steve
setup.
His name is.
Am I right in thinking that the camera setup is the same around the stadium? Yep. And because the game
four
was brought
cameras, one, two, game, three on the gantry, the and then game, you just have a few other bits of fluff in the middle.
The game was broadcast both on Amazon Prime and on Channel 4, so the feed would have been the same. The
Channel
direction.
4 would have taken the feed, yeah, and then their bits around the game would have been, so Channel 4 would have had their own cameras there to do presentation and whatnot, but match cameras would have been the same.
So people that are whinging about zooming in and out.
Strange close-ups and weird angles and just not really good flow and comments that the cameramen have clearly never watched a rugby match before.
Same fellas that do 70, 80 matches a year.
Well, I think they're the same people that were probably moaning that Amazon is shit because it was buffering.
Yeah.
And it was pixelating, and they didn't see it very well.
I tell you what, my Amazon is absolutely fine for everything else. So if I'm trying to watch a film or whatever on Amazon Prime, it works perfectly fine. But the sport, when they tried the football, I couldn't watch it, and I can't watch it down.
Is it something to do with the bit rate or something, Russ?
I think it must be because
it might be online rather than pre. But there's no chance for it to catch up as such, is there?
When you watch the motorbikes on BT, there's quite a lot of ghosting.
If I watch it on my Fire Stick, I can watch it, but not on the normal. Yeah.
And I think some people had it the other way around, that it was pixelating on a Fire Stick, but then not directly into a TV. I had it on an app on the TV, and it was absolutely perfect. In fact, I had it streaming on the app on the TV on Amazon Prime while I was watching Sky Sports on a laptop.
I wonder if it could be even
streaming
as like
in cinema makes amounts of porn on my phone at the same time.
it could be something along the lines of like the way your colors are set up on your TV just requires a higher bit rate to, I don't know.
It could be device specific. It could be people's broadband. It could be lots of things. I think ultimately it's not Amazon's fault. If for Amazon Prime, if it works perfectly for one single person, then they are doing their job because they are broadcasting it to a quality that is streamable.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to Switch Over Podcast.
Yeah, I would say that though that, you know, if you think that any coverage of rugby in this country is done by people who don't know it, then you're probably watching something on the BBC because there's a very specific BBC crew that do all the BBC stuff. They're mostly retired or were made redundant from the BBC in the 90s and are now coining it in as freelancers, pretty much working on anything the BBC does. But if it's an ITV production or a Channel 4 or BT or Sky, it's not that many people that do all of this stuff, and we tend to do it all. So you're talking out your ass if you people that don't know what they're doing.
How's that 45-minute pod working out for you, Ross?
Say that again, mate.
Is that 45-minute long pod working out for you?
Yeah. Well, we're an hour and five in, aren't we?
On the subject of the coverage, did anyone think Benjamin Kayser was really good in the French game?
I did. I enjoyed Benjamin Kayser. Yeah. He was entertaining as well as being informative.
And they had Andrew Cotter as well, so I suppose that always helps, I think. Yeah. So, yeah.
They've got quite a good little crew, old Amazon Prime, I think. They're doing all right. And, you know, I think that they've bought a slightly different dimension, so fair play. Does anybody want to talk anything about Bristol and Wasps yesterday before we wrap up?
Just say it was a great try. Yeah. Brilliant try.
From your mate Doug had a nice little break and hand off inside to Tom Willis. I know you're a big fan.
It was a great try. Great try.
It was a good game. It was bitty, and it was almost almost typical first game of the season. There were lots of errors, lots of mistakes, but as far as a contest goes, it was a good contest, and I think Bristol shot themselves in the foot to a certain extent.
I think he's much better than he looked because he's so ugly.
His really pointy face. I feel like if you threw him into the ground, it'd stick.
That's Mrs. Bassett, not listening anymore, isn't it?
Like a human javelin.
He'd wedge himself between the cracks in the pavement.
Yeah, like Rust would roll, but Josh Bassett would just sort of doing like that. Ross is frozen. He's had enough. Look, that's one insult too many, isn't it?
He's
Ross, are you dead?
His silence speaks volumes. You know what? That's still
Ross's laptop has just died. So I'll take over the hosting responsibilities.
Position Russ has just frozen.
You recorded.
Oh God! I hope everything else is recorded. Should we do any other business, Ben? Because now Russ is dead. I feel like we should probably stop talking about rugby.
Yeah, that image that he froze in was quite unpleasant, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Get how he gets his finger that far up his ass. I don't know.
any other business? There was a good couple of documentaries on BBC Two about Cornwall with Simon Reeve, which I thought were really good, sort of painted Cornwall in a bit more realistic light than Doc Martin or Countryfile. But there was a nice old chap in Camborne who was running a food bank called Don, and he carried on filming.
The food bank was called Don.
It was, yeah, Don's Food Bank, in fact. But yeah, he carried on filming the documentary, even though his wife had died in the week of the documentary was being filmed, and he was carrying on with the food bank and stuff. And I think they're after donations, so if I can find a link, I'll share that later on if anyone's interested in taking a look. But yeah, very kind gentleman who made me feel bad about myself.
it did bring a little tear to my eye.
There you go. That's that was quite nice, Ben.
Yeah. Thanks, mate.
There was us. Phil.
Yeah, so the Prime Minister's been on today giving us some guidance about post-lockdown and what's going to happen. And they've done the classic thing that this government appeared to do of just massively overcomplicating it. We've got a 97-tier, 43-colour system where you can meet somebody called Brian on a Tuesday, but only if he wipes his ass with his left hand, and only outdoors within a distance of 3.72 feet. And we're at a situation where actually what's happened with coronavirus is the countries that are doing really well now, massive economic recovery, are those that have a really harsh lockdown, close down international borders for 6 weeks, get it under control, and then you can rebuild from there and stop it bringing it in. But if you're not going to do that, scrap all the bloody lockdown crap, just give people guidance. If you mix with other people, you're at risk of getting coronavirus. So limit the number of people you mix with. Just take sensible precautions. Don't go hugging every other Tom, Dick and Harry. Don't go coughing in people's faces. And just leave people to make their own decisions. Or do something properly about it. Just this farcical thing. We're doing this because we have to control the disease. But the measures we put in probably aren't going to work anyway. So all we're doing is pissing people off. And that's my coronavirus rant of the month.
You can't have, sorry, my fucking laptop died. You can't have people not mixing and then loads of snotty nosed
and open the pubs and the restaurants.
Well, it's not even about it to me, it's about the schools and the place where the virus will spread the most. Oh yeah, but we can all stay apart as adults and keep away from each other and do whatever it is we need to do and not do anything that means we can live our lives. But yet the kids will go to school and sit in a class, even if they're in their own little bubble of six people on a table or whatever. Only takes one of those. It's utter bullshit. And it fucks me off so much that it's completely disregarded, because the minute they close the schools, they basically have to draw a line under the economy, because people will say, well, I can't work because my kids are at home. And then it's that vicious circle. So they cannot forcibly close the schools, because that would kill the economy even more. It's doing my head in.
I think public liberty restrictions are sad.
Well played. Well played.
I just don't care anymore.
No, the atmosphere here has turned rather sour.
All I know is that next week we can play golf again.
Yeah. Yeah. Russ, I took over. So why don't you do any other business, mate?
I just want to do another other business about insurance companies, and I know you've had fairly recent.
I think we could go through any one of the Mall Over podcast conglomerates productions. Probably every sixth podcast has a moan about insurance companies.
Yeah, that's true. But I just want to say,
let that stop you, though, Russ.
I've had two different things come up for insurance renewal over the last couple of days. Firstly, being my car insurance, another year with no claims on it. You know, humble brag.
Well, but, hang on a minute. That was
over 12 months ago, and that was the missus' insurance. So let's not worry about that. So another year with no claims on my insurance. Yet my insurance premium, they just tried to say, well, we're going to put your insurance premium up by X amount for the year. This is your renewal. So I rang them up and said, well, I don't want to renew then, if that's the case. I'm not interested. I'll shop around. And like any other thing, they went, oh, hang on there, Mr. Milson. Let's see what we can do for you. And then they bought it down below what I'm paying now. So not only did they try and put the price up by £150 a year, they've knocked £50 off a year what I'm already paying now.
Because they want you to not notice and auto-renew.
Yeah, but who doesn't notice? You have to be an utter fucking imbecile not to notice.
If the last 8 months haven't taught you anything.
Yeah, that's true.
Other than that most people are fucking imbeciles, then I don't know how to help you.
That's true. And the other one was around fucking pet insurance, but let's not even get me started on that. Fucking dogs.
I mean, look, pet insurance. So what, your dog's poorly? Throw it off a cliff. Go and get another one. There's fucking millions of them.
Farm them
in. There's not. There's a massive pet shortage in the UK now because as soon as lockdown
you know why? Yeah, I know I shouldn't have said anything bad about animals.
You know why? Elkins
I'm with that, but like a crossbred, a 9-month-old crossbred mongrel is going for about £600. Absolutely bonkers because I'm not having shortage of dogs.
This country.
Where did you get yours, Ben? Did you get one of yours from one of those Russian farms?
It's actually a mink.
it's like a cocker spaniel battery farm.
It's a mink and it's got a cough and it likes bacon.
I mean, the way it was chowing down its food at the start of this podcast, I wouldn't have fucking doubted it.
No, came from a reputable breeder, officer.
Ivan Dogolotovich.
Pavlov's dog. Right, let's go.
She was
any other business?
I don't know. Have you not done it already?
We actually got her off a very nice lady. She turned up in a 1950s sports car. She had a big fur coat and she had quite a few Dalmatians with her.
Surname DeVille.
Two quick ones for me. Just obviously you all know I'm a bit of a telly person. Just an absolute golden age of telly at the moment. If you haven't watched The Mandalorian, I implore you, if you're even like us, I know you're what you'll say, Russ, but it is unashamedly a Western set in space. Right down to when people are walking, it sounds like Spurs and they're in like Wild West towns. It's incredible, an incredible bit of TV that even people you wouldn't like think would like Star Wars like Star Wars.
Is Star Wars the one with the little wizard boy?
Anyway,
well played.
The other one is The Crown, which is
fuck that as well.
Season 4 of The
Crown. Fuck that hard.
One of the best pieces of television I've ever seen.
Diana dies again.
Just started watching a show on BBC iPlayer called Industry, which is quite good. If you like watching people perform oral sex, you might like it. check that out. And if you like food programs and you've got Netflix, can I recommend The Chef Show with Jon Favreau and Roy Choi? It's really, really good.
I know I know Roy's brother.
Hack.
That predictable? Yeah, fair enough.
So there you go. There's about 70 hours worth of television I've just recommended.
Fuck all of you. The Queen's speech, the fucking Queen, whatever it's called.
Do you remember when we threw a piece of toast at her and told her to eat that? You can.
Yes, I do. I mean that actually happened. And what a story that is.
Yeah.
Throwing a piece of toast at a portrait of the Queen.
If you like the whole story, you can subscribe to our Patreon.
It was quite fun.
Eat that, you cunt. I've just done a massive flashback and I'm literally in that foyer right now. That is incredible. Oh, fuck me. Oh, I mean, if I could call the podcast that, it would be amazing. But I can't. So I'm crying. I'm literally crying. And one day we'll tell that story in full. But we'll leave you in that. Like a cliffhanger. Come back next week.
Pull the curtain back. We spoke before we came on air about having a podcast that lasted less than an hour and a half because they're really annoying when they go that long. And here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, true. True, true. Right, let's go then. We'll come back next week. Do it all again. This was fun. See you boys later. Go well.
Social Podcast Network.